TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Rupert, Crossing the Rubicon. Truth and Lies of 9/11. This is a speech given at the prestigious San Francisco Commonwealth Club on August 31st, 2004. Introduced by Commonwealth Club staff as presenter of possibly one of the most unpleasant programs of the year, Mike Rupert promised to show proof, and even name names, of U.S. government officials who, he says, knew of the September 11 attacks and helped them along. Mike Rupert's talk came on the eve of the release of his new book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire and the End of the Age of Oil. Published by New Society Publishers, the book has been described as the detective story of the century. In support of these serious charges leveled by Rupert, the book offers over 600 pages of text and documents, and over 1,000 footnotes. Mike Rupert was a detective with the L.A. Police Department until he realized that the small-time drug dealers that he arrested were supplied by big-time sources. He showed that the CIA was involved in bringing cocaine into the black neighborhoods of Los Angeles. Rupert lost his job and began his own investigative work, first into drug running by the U.S. government, then into the phenomenon of peak oil, explained in more detail in today's program. He became involved in the 9/11 investigative movement and is well known for having presented a timeline about the inexplicable failure of the U.S. air defenses to intercept the hijacked planes. His research can be found on the website fromthewilderness.com. That's fromthewilderness.com. Mike Rupert began his exploration at the Commonwealth Club by reminding us of a number of strange facts in the official story of 9/11. 3 years after the terrible crimes of 9/11 and a worldwide manhunt, not a single successful 9/11 conviction has occurred anywhere. Likewise, nobody has been charged with negligence on the part of any number of government agencies for failing to act to prevent the crime. Now you are about to hear Mike Rupert talk about the official 9/11 investigation, or rather about some of the 9/11 commissioners and their serious conflicts of interest. Today's program lays the groundwork for the upcoming second part, in which Rupert actually names names. Here is Mike Rupert, recorded at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, investigating the investigators.
In describing to you just a few of these conflicts of interest, I'd like to express my thanks to independent journalist Jim Rary, who did a magnificent job of cataloging the histories of the wolves and the foxes who managed the hen house of the September 11th investigation. Thomas Keene, chairman. Tom Keene is a director and shareholder of Amirata Hess Corporation, which is involved in the Hess Delta joint venture with Delta Oil of Saudi Arabia, owned by the Khalid bin Mahfouz and Alamoudi clans. That company was involved in the initial planning for a trans-Afghan oil pipeline just prior to September the 11th. Khalid bin Mahfouz, once a senior executive with the legendary organized crime bank BCCI, is Saudi Arabia's largest banker. And his clients include both the Saudi royal family and the bin Laden group of companies. Coincidentally, the former governor of New Jersey is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, together with another prominent member of the board of directors of Amirata Hess, former Secretary of the Treasury, Nick Brady. It's also worth mentioning that Tom Keene also sits as co-chairman of the Homeland Security Project. Under the auspices of the Century Foundation, in this capacity, Keene played a key role in the draft recommendations of the report and legislation which laid the groundwork for the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Journalist Wayne Madsen has shown us with ample documentation that George W. Bush also had business relations with Khalid bin Mahfouz, when he was in the Texas oil business. You have to say business. Both George W. Bush and Khalid bin Mahfouz were also implicated in the BCCI scandal, closely tied to the Iran-Contra and the savings and loan scandals. Other links between Bush and bin Mahfouz can be found through investments in the Carlyle Group, an American investment firm managed by a board on which former President George Herbert Walker Bush himself once sat, was sitting on 9/11. The younger Bush personally held shares in one of Carlyle's companies, Cater Air. Let's talk about Lee Hamilton, the vice chair, one of my favorite guys. In 1987, House Speaker Jim Wright, who later resigned in disgrace, appointed Lee Hamilton to chair a committee investigating the Iran-Contra affair. When a question was raised about CIA-Contra drug smuggling, the response was a release by Hamilton of a cursory review that concluded that there was no truth to the charges. The CIA released a report in October of 1998, Volume 2 of the CIA's Inspector General Report on Iran-Contra Drug Trafficking, that received almost no publicity, yet it admitted the drug connection and direct CIA involvement in the transshipment of thousands of kilos of cocaine. Hamilton played a key role in the so-called October Surprise of 1980-81, in which it was charged that the Reagan-Bush campaign team was reported to have secretly negotiated with Iran's revolutionary government to delay release of the American hostages held at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. The deal was that the hostages would be released after the presidential election so that Jimmy Carter could not benefit from their release before the election. The evidence was serious enough to warrant congressional hearings, which were ultimately chaired by Lee Hamilton. As most of us who are old enough recall, the hostages were not released until the very day of Ronald Reagan's first inauguration in January of 1981. This was one of history's greatest coincidences. For more than four decades, veteran Washington journalist Sarah McClendon was the grand dame of the White House press corps until her January 2003 death at 92. She was a revered and active journalist known for her feisty confrontations with presidents and the powerful dating back to the Truman administration. In her later years, she had a great habit of appearing to be asleep in her wheelchair until the moment when she would wake up and pounce on her prey with incisive questions that revealed she hadn't missed a word of what had been said. Once on national television in the middle of a live White House press conference, she even dared to question President Bill Clinton about the abundantly documented record of CIA and Arkansas state government involvement in drug smuggling operations at Arkansas's Mena Regional Intermountain Airport during the 1980s. In 1994 and 1995, while living in Washington, I was a regular attendee at McClendon's weekly study group at the National Press Club, and later at her residence on Connecticut Avenue. After she passed, the National Press Club renamed one of its conference rooms as the McClendon Room. In 1992, McClendon offered her observation on Lee Hamilton's behavior as the chief fact finder and chair of the October Surprise and Iran-Contra committees. Quote, I wish I could do her voice. She had a great voice. I declined to withdraw the report I made that Congressman Hyde elicited and obtained a promise from Chairman Lee Hamilton of the House Task Force on the October Surprise that the group would clear President George Bush of going to Paris to cinch a deal of weapons for Iran in exchange for retaining American hostages to be delivered to President Ronald Reagan and not to outgoing President Jimmy Carter. Hyde says he made no such a deal, and I must remember that Hamilton is a Democrat. That makes no difference. Hamilton held a press conference to clear Bush before the investigation into the deal between the Reagan-Bush candidates for presidential office and the Iranians had even started. Hamilton then admitted he had not interrogated witnesses or talked with his special attorney hired to investigate the matter. Iran-Contra and all of its horrific corruption was effectively managed by Lee Hamilton in the House and John Kerry, among others, in the Senate. Throughout the late 1980s to conceal the greatest crimes of the era, crimes committed by a litany of well-known government operatives. At the same time, Hamilton was the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. While many activists regard John Kerry as something of a hero for bringing many of the details of Iran-Contra drug activities to light and into the public record, others more deeply versed and immersed in the evidentiary record suspect that he also did a masterful job of keeping some of the most damaging Iran-Contra secrets especially records of CIA proprietary company operations. He kept those records hidden, and I am among the latter group. I believe John Kerry was part of the cover-up of Iran-Contra. Many figures who came under criminal and investigative scrutiny in Iran-Contra, like John Poindexter, Elliot Abrams, Richard Armitage, Dick Cheney, Otto Reich, Colin Powell, and John Negroponte, returned with little or no congressional opposition to serve in the current Bush administration after the 2000 so-called election. Veteran AP journalist Bob Perry, who broke the first major story linking drug smuggling to Contra support activities, only to later lose his job, offered some additional observations on Lee Hamilton. Quote, "One of the key congressional Republicans fighting the rearguard action was Representative Dick Cheney of Wyoming, who became the high-ranking House Republican on the Iran-Contra investigation. Cheney already enjoyed a favorable reputation in Washington as a steady and conservative hand. Cheney smartly exploited his relationship with Representative Lee Hamilton D. Indiana, who was chairman of the Iran-Contra panel, and Hamilton cared deeply about his reputation for bipartisanship, and the Republicans quickly exploited this fact. Not only did Hamilton fail to find any wrongdoing, he was even satisfied with the performance of Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North in the Iran-Contra hearings. As one commentator connected to the National Security Archives, Peter Kornbluth, observed, North appears before the House Select Committee on Intelligence to answer questions about his role in Iran-Contra, Contra resupply operation. He lies convincingly. He has not in any way at any time violated the principles or the legal requirements of the Boland Amendment, which bans federal support for the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionaries. Committee Chairman Lee Hamilton, D. Indiana, pronounces himself satisfied with North's good faith. When North's superior John Poindexter is told of his successful deception of Congress, Poindexter emails Ali, well done. Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the Independent Commission investigating 9/11. Perhaps no more glaring conflict of interest attracted opposition from victim families and 9/11 activists than that of the commission's executive director, Philip Zelikow. Concerns were raised when it was disclosed that only two commission members and Zelikow might be allowed to see certain classified presidential records, including the much ballyhooed, debated presidential daily brief of August 6, 2001. Personally, I viewed the August 6 PDB as a red herring and a hubristic pretext over which the commission could make a show of battling the administration for information. The PDB, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S., was eventually released in a one-and-a-half-page version that was presented to the world as complete. Nothing could have been further from the truth. The respected German paper Die Zeit published a story in October 2002, well before the PDB became an issue, stating that the PDB was actually 11 1/2 pages long. Since I had documented so many other clear and direct warnings of the 9/11 attacks, the August 6 PDB was a non-issue for me. In crossing the Rubicon, I will document more than a dozen specific warnings which would have foretold hijacked airliners being crashed into the World Trade Center during the week of September the 9th. Other warnings, such as massive insider trading on financial markets from Hong Kong to Tokyo to San Francisco to Chicago to New York to London and Berlin, told those who were watching that the airlines involved would be United and American. The insider trading, acknowledged and documented by the likes of CBS News and Bloomberg, what do they know about reporting or finance, and respected financial commentators, many others, was given the complete brush off by the Kane Commission in its final report. All it said was that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda did not make the trades. Well, so what? I knew that. Who did? In my book, I will tell you, or I will give you an idea of the people who did make those trades. Hundreds of billions of dollars in one comment from a German official, estimated as high as $150 billion by CBS. No answer. The controversy arising from the public debate over Zelikow forced even the New York Times to comment on some of his more obvious conflicts of interest. Advocates for the family said they were alarmed by the commission's disclosure on Thursday that only one of the 10 commissioners would have access to a wide range of the briefings, and that the only person from the commission with similar access would be its staff director, Phil Zelikow, who has close ties to Condoleezza Rice and other officials in the Bush administration. The commission has previously rejected a request from victims' families to limit Mr. Zelikow's responsibilities sharply in light of potential conflict of interest involving the White House. Now, this is the New York Times. The family's advocate said the decision to have Mr. Zelikow be one of only two commission officials with wide access to the highly classified documents. The other is Jamie S. Gorelick, a Democratic commission member who was deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. This raised new questions about the investigation's impartiality. Mr. Zelikow, who wrote a book with Ms. Rice, executive director of the 9/11 commission, co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. Is that not a conflict of interest? Has acknowledged having contacts earlier in the year with Karl Rove. Now, there's one of my favorite people. President Bush's chief political advisor about Mr. Zelikow's scholarly work at the University of Virginia. What's more, Mr. Zelikow had been serving as a member of President Bush's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board since 2001, and he had also made a September 2002 public statement on the record that U.S. military action against Iraq would be based upon a desire to protect Israeli interests rather than any real threat from Iraq. Quote, "Perhaps the worst conflict of interest was the fact that Zelikow had advised the incoming Bush administration on terror-related intelligence matters and had several discussions about bin Laden and al-Qaeda in 2000 and 2001 with Richard Clark. By rights, he should have been a witness testifying under oath before the commission instead of its executive director. When many of the victim families learned of this, they were justifiably outraged at an arrangement that would have never been permitted in a court of law. In spite of all the controversy and calls from many for his resignation, Phil Zelikow remains the executive director of the Kane Commission today." Slade Gorton. Slade Gorton is a former senator from the state of Washington. After he lost his reelection bid in 2000, he joined the Seattle law firm of Preston, Gates, and Ellis, which specializes in environmental studies. If jury selection rules were being used, Gorton would probably be dismissed from consideration for the commission for cause. That's a technical term for conflict of interest. 2 days after the 9/11 attacks, he told a public television audience there was nothing government officials could have done to thwart the attack, according to the Seattle Times. The Times quoted Gorton as saying, "I doubt we can expect to get too much inside information no matter what we do." He said that before he even sat down on the commission. That's a prejudicial point of view. It's disqualifying automatically. Gorton served 2 years on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he says that his experience and his personal friendship with Trent Lott were responsible for his appointment to that post by Lott. Every commission member has deep conflicts of interest with respect to 9/11 and its so-called investigation of the government. Now I have to turn to the motive for 9/11. Peak oil is no secret. Its chief opponent is something called denial, which is not a river in Egypt. Dick Cheney knew about it. I will show you that in my book. His National Energy Policy Development Group knew about it. You know, the one that refused to release its records, sparking a constitutional crisis and a Supreme Court ruling after Dick Cheney took Justice Scalia duck hunting at Secret Service expense. I will talk to you about that in my book, too. Oil and natural gas are indispensable to our way of life. The world consumes 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food that is eaten. All commercial fertilizers are made from natural gas. All commercial pesticides are made from petroleum. All irrigation, plowing, harvesting, planting, transport is accomplished by either oil-powered machinery or oil or natural gas-generated electricity. There are between 600 and 700 million internal combustion-powered vehicles on the planet, and the demand for them is exploding exponentially, especially in China, where GM sales rose 300% in 1 year alone. According to the National Geographic, this last June, I hope you all saw the huge cover story in National Geographic, all about peak oil. There are 7 gallons of oil in every tire. Think about that, 7 gallons of oil in every tire. So, if we want to suddenly build 600 new vehicles that are powered by some new phantasmagorical alternative energy source, hydrogen is a cruel joke. If we wanted to build 600 million new vehicles, four tires each, how much oil would be required to do that? To mine and melt the ore, to transport it to the factories that don't exist using electricity that isn't there, to make the paints, solvents, and all of the plastic needed. All plastic is made from oil. Hydrogen, like I said, is a cruel joke. It creates a false hope. I love Governor Schwarzenegger. I love when he talks about the hydrogen highway. Yeah, I'll pump you up. Yeah, but hydrogen, yeah, sure. Hydrogen is a joke. It's made from natural gas. It's a net energy loser. China's economic growth has seen it replace Japan as the world's second largest importer of oil, and China is now coming into direct economic and political competition with the United States for what oil remains. I have attended two international conferences on the subject of peak oil and its implications for civilization, one in Paris in 2003 and one in Berlin this year. And for almost the entire year between the Paris and the Berlin conferences, the icons of the mainstream press, the ones known and employed to mold public and business perception, the ones who have to get it right at least part of the time in the facts they talk about, have been acknowledging peak oil's reality, sometimes reluctantly, sometimes less than directly, but also sometimes very boldly. CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, The Economist, dozens of media giants have begun to respond like a giant ship turning slowly in the water. The subject of peak oil is one which requires a little study to get your brain around. It does not, however, require much science except for basic arithmetic. Discoveries of large oil deposits have been in steep decline since 1962. Demand, on the other hand, as well as population, has been soaring. To quote my energy editor, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, a geologist, quote, it appears that the year 2007 will be important. A new study published in the Petroleum Review suggests that production might not be able to keep up with demand in 2007. The study is a survey of mega projects, those with reserves of over 500 million barrels, and the potential to produce over 100,000 barrels of oil a day. Now, these are all numbers now. I'll put them in perspective in a second. Mega projects are important not only because they provide the bulk of world oil production, but also because they have a better net energy profile than smaller projects, and they provide a more substantial profit than smaller projects. There's a report that Ghawar, the single largest oil field on the planet, is now 55% water cut, meaning that 55% of what they pump out of Ghawar every day is the same seawater they pumped in that morning to push the oil up. When the water cut reaches 70-80%, usually the field collapses entirely. And if Ghawar collapses, the planet collapses. Ghawar, according to a lot of research, we need to discover, to meet demand, three more Ghawars within the next 5 years. Ghawar was 900 million to a billion barrels. We haven't found one of those since we found that one. But there is another factor to this oil calculus. So many complaints are being voiced that a major part of the problem with current oil prices has to do with a lack of refineries. People point out 18 different grades of gas in the country, different states you can't, and nobody's building refineries. And the answer is simple. Refineries aren't being built because there can't be any return on investment. The oil companies know that there's not going to be any oil to refine in the new refineries if they build them to get their money back. We're supposed to find 10 new North Sea fields which are going dry. Recent events have clearly demonstrated the fragility of a global production system that is operating at full tilt. Sabotage an Iraqi pipeline one day and the price goes up. Announced that Vladimir Putin is easing up on Russian oil giant Yukos and the price drops. Announced that Putin is moving to sell off Yukos' assets and confiscate its cash, the price soars. Worry that Hugo Chavez of Venezuela might be ousted in a violent coup, the price jumps. Watch Chavez, who is despised by the Bush administration, win his seventh election in as many years, and the price drops. By the way, that's seven more elections than George Bush has ever won. In spite of repeated assurances from the Saudi government that they can and are increasing production, the evidence is growing that they cannot. Now, I've been joined by many people around the world in saying that 9/11 was an inside job, including people like Michael Meacher, the former British Environment Minister, and my dear friend Andreas von Bülow, former member of the German Parliament, Parliamentary Secretary, and just a wonderful human being. We're watching these crises now adding up around the world. People just refuse to believe that we're running out of oil, but I ask you briefly to consider this. Britain's largest electricity provider has announced that prices will soar as much as 40% next year. Wholesale energy prices have doubled in the last year as Bloomberg has announced that the decline in North Sea production is creating a trade gap, which is threatening to upset the British economy. In March, Reuters reported that Argentina, facing its worst energy crisis in 15 years, is becoming unstable as it's cutting back natural gas exports to Chile next door, threatening Chilean electric production. The BBC reported recently that high oil prices are threatening many Asian economies. Just 2 weeks ago, the Australian government ordered an emergency fuel review in anticipation of future crises. On August 25th, it was reported that Brazil was opening negotiations with Ecuador. China is now enforcing blackouts in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and several other cities. Now, bear in mind that planet Earth consumes 1 billion barrels of oil every 1.5 days. The discovery rate for mega projects has dwindled to almost nothing. This can be seen in the data for the last few years. In 2000, there were 16 discoveries of over 500 million barrels. In 2001, there were only 8 new discoveries. In 2002, there were only 3 such discoveries. From first discovery to first production generally takes about 6 years. If the new project can make use of existing infrastructure, then the time is cut to 4. What this means is these mega fields, in other words, the world uses a mega field about every 6 days. Now, in 2003, for the entire year, for the first time since the 1920s, there was not a single discovery of a mega field. We've eaten all the low-lying fruits.
That was Mike Rupert, author of the just-released book, Crossing the Rubicon. In the next program by TUC Radio, Rupert presents astounding new material. On the day of 9/11, war games were conducted in the northeastern sector of the U.S. 3 of the games had identical scenarios to the real crimes. They were simulated hijackings. Also, by strange coincidence, New York was conducting a bioweapons exercise on September 11 and had set up a fully staffed FEMA, New York City, and Department of Justice command post on Manhattan's Pier 29. That was conveniently used as command post after the Twin Towers had collapsed. That's coming up in the next program of TUC Radio. You can find more information on Mike Rupert on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a 1-hour tape or CD of the talk by Mike Rupert by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gelardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.